Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the study of antiquity and the Middle Ages. As always, I'm your host, Nick Barksdale, and today we're joined by a very special guest, PhD student Theodore Nash. Theo, thank you so much for coming on the channel today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nick. It's great to be here.
And before we begin this awesome series, I'm going to have Theo tell us a little bit about himself so you all can get to know him. He's an awesome guy. I can't wait to jump into the series, and I really think you are all going to enjoy it. Theo, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So I am a third-year PhD student at the University of Michigan in its interdepartmental program in classical art and archaeology, which is entirely too long to say, so we just call it IPCA. So I study the Greek Bronze Age, so the Mycenaeans and their culture, and the writing system which they use, which we call Linear B, and what it can tell us about how people lived 3,500 years ago.
And also, to my subscribers, check out the links in the video description below. It's going to take you to stuff that he's worked on, so like his personal website where he can walk you through his research, things like academia, and really give him your support. Check out what he's trying to do and really take advantage of the awesome insights that he has to offer. Now, let's talk about a favorite, and that is writing systems. So let's talk about the writing before, if there was any, and then after the arrival of Indo-Europeans?
So this question brings us to Crete, where sort of the center of gravity for the Greek world and the through the Bronze Age. Crete is where we start to see complex society develop for the first time in the Aegean. And it's a driving force all the way through until the very, very end, maybe, when it looks like maybe the mainland has, there's about a couple centuries where you can argue that the mainland is doing things more important than what's happening on Crete. And then Crete continues to be tremendously important through the following period, though it's less well understood then. So on Crete, around the beginning, the end of the third millennium, beginning of the second millennium BC, so around 2000 BC, right, we start to get what we call palaces. Not a great word, but it's the word we have, it's the word we use. These large complexes that centralize religious and religious authority with probably secular authority, with probably input and output of goods, controlling trade in the region, all these things that the palaces do. And so one of the things which comes with the palaces is writing. So we have on Crete, the story of writing on Crete is incredibly rich and interesting. And in fact, it's why people started digging on Crete. So we had these seal stones with these carved sort of pictographic figures. And these were, people would find them and they would wear them. They were called like milk stones or milk charms. And people, would use them as sort of talismanic things. And in this is the natives on Crete in the late 19th century. And as European, trying to think of like explorers, that's the wrong word, but as European intellectuals and dilettantes, things like this, as they're coming to Crete and seeing these things, they're starting to get interested in them because this is the same time period, sort of this same period is when we've deciphered the cuneiform languages in the Near East. So there's a lot of excitement about what ancient languages can tell us. And so all of this. And so Arthur Evans, who was an Englishman, his father was an important anthropologist, John Evans. And Evans, he was at Oxford. He was associated with the Ashmolean Museum. He did some journalism in the Balkans. And so as he was traveling around, he started to find these things. And he was interested in them because he thought that what he was seeing on these stones, these pictographic figures, often, sort of three in a row almost down the side of a little stone or something like this, and maybe on the other sides as well. These are very much what we call today seal stones. And so he was thinking, well, maybe this is writing. And so he and others wanted to excavate at Knossos. So in the 1870s, Schliemann had excavated at Mycenae, and he had made all of his remarkable discoveries there, the gold death masks, the incredibly wealthy burials of Grave Circle A. And this, Schliemann had earlier and later, Schliemann was mostly interested in excavating at Troy. He found that more interesting and easier. So when Schliemann first excavated at Troy, he stole a lot of his finds. The Ottoman government did not realize that he was doing this, and they weren't thrilled that he had. And so when he went to Greece, they didn't want him to steal stuff. So they actually had a Greek archaeologist work with him so that they could record what was happening and make sure he wasn't taking stuff. And Schliemann did his famous excavation in Mycenae. He also dug a little bit at Tiryns and a little bit in a few other regions. But he found, it seems that he found the Greek oversight a little bit overbearing, and so didn't spend too much more time in Greece. And this is something interesting about the early days of archaeology is that basically people funded digs on the expectation that they would be repaid by what they discovered. This is what's happening in the Near East as well. People are giving money to these people to excavate at Babylon or Nineveh or any of these sites. And the expectation is that they're going to saw off some giant relief sculpture and take it back to the British Museum, or someone's going to get to keep it in their backyard. And it's bizarre to think about today, but this is how they treated it. And this is how Schliemann wanted to treat it and did. And so this is all we're getting now in the later 19th century, as you can sort of guess from how the Greek government is treating it, we're getting towards the development of archaeology as something more than treasure hunting, though Schliemann is very much on the treasure hunting side of things. The difference between Schliemann, who goes digging at Mycenae, and Troy, in the first case to prove Homer right, which he made the question more complicated. And the question of whether there was a Trojan War remains an open one. But it was certainly his discoveries and the subsequent work at these sites has been incredibly important for how we understand that. But he's also digging for gold. He's digging for treasure, and he wants that treasure, and he wants to use it to countries, nascent nation states in Europe, or even old imperial powers would use the discovery of these ancient sites and the display of ancient artifacts from different regions as ways of showing off, the excavations in the Near East were in many parts, the English wanted to show something off in the British Museum before the French could show it in the Louvre, but when we get to, Schliemann had also wanted to excavate at Knossos. So Knossos is really basically the only example in the Aegean of what we would call in the Near East a tell, which is the mound left by generations and generations and thousands of years of inhabitation. These things don't go away, which is why we have archaeology. And if you're in the same site for long enough, eventually things just build up because you sort of build on top of things rather than, you don't have bulldozers. You're not going to clear the whole area. If your palace burns down, you're probably just going to build on top of it. And this is what happens at Troy. And we have these massive tells in the Near East. Knossos is basically the only site in the Aegean inhabited long enough and on a large enough scale for this to happen. So people knew that this site was interesting. Schliemann had wanted to excavate there. The local authorities did not particularly want people to excavate the site of Knossos because Crete was still part, though Greece had already won independence by the late 19th century from the Ottoman Empire. Crete was not yet part of modern Greece, and so there was a real concern. So Crete was not yet part of the nation of Greece, and so there was a real concern, again, with this imperialism, that if people dug up cool things at Knossos, then they would just end up in Istanbul. All right, so the imperialism was still a factor, and this continued to be a factor until after the Cretan independence was won in a very, very horrific sort of civil war in the very, very late, very end of the 19th century, right around 1900. The violence on both sides was horrific. But after this, it becomes part of Greece. And so Schliemann is dead at this point. He dies in the early 1890s, I think. So he never gets to dig there, which is probably good for us. Evans is able to buy the land. And in fact, the site of Knossos is still owned. And when Evans dies, he gives it to the British school at Athens. So it's still actually owned by British people. It's not actually owned by the Greek state, which is a bit interesting, sort of holdover from how things used to work. So Evans is able to buy the land and excavate. And right, as I was saying, Schliemann was digging in order to prove Homer right and in order to find gold. Is very much this old model of the you know, the curious intellectual, the treasure hunter. Evans is, because he's a little bit later, archaeology is a bit more developed at this point, and he's, you know, he's looking for writing and he's trying to tell more of a story. So that you can see sort of how attitudes towards these things are changing. And so he excavates the palace starting in April of 1900, I think, maybe 1901. And he starts to find writing right away, really staggering that he manages to, I mean, so we find tablets all across the palace. It's not particularly meaningful that he finds them right away, but it is interesting in hindsight that really, and we'll see a similar thing actually when excavations start at Pelos. And so he starts to find these tablets. And so as he's excavating at Knossos and as others are excavating across Crete, because things sort of are a lot more free for excavation now that Crete is no longer part of the Ottoman Empire. So there's excavations at the west, in the west. The Italians are digging at Phaistos and Iatriada. And then in the east, the French are digging at Malia, and Harriet Boyd Hawes, the American, digs at Gornios. So there's a lot of excavation in Crete in the early 20th century. And as part of this, we start to develop this picture of multiple writing systems in use across a long time frame. And so the seal stones that Evans knew about at first and thought were a form of writing, they were, and they found a lot more of these. And we find tablets with the same sort of signs written on them in clay. So they're going to look a little bit different, because if you're carving something on stone, it's going to look different than if you're writing it on clay with a stylus, but you can still tell the similarity. So we have what we call Cretan hieroglyphic, which is a name that Evans gave it, not in any way related to Egyptian hieroglyphics, we don't think. So there are many reasons for thinking this. One, there's very little overlap in sign shape. It doesn't appear that there's any direct influence. Where there is some similarity, it's also where things look like things in the real world. So it's more likely that Minoans knew what cats would look like and that Egyptians knew what cats looked like, rather than that they needed each other's pictures of cats to figure it out. And the way they seem to record language looks to be different. So the origins of writing on Crete is a fascinating question and not an easy one to answer. But we end up with this picture where the earliest writing, it's complicated, but it does seem like this sort of pictographic Cretan hieroglyphic writing is the earliest we have. We have a deposit from a site called Arkanes in central Crete. People sometimes break it off, call it the Arkanes script, but really it's hieroglyphic. It looks like the hieroglyphic signs. And in fact, the sequence that we get looks a lot like a sequence we get in the next script, which is Linear A. So it seems like this is the origins, and it seems like they have a common origin. So Linear A, so these names are not great. And I don't think they were ever really intended to be the names that we use all the time. So when Evans is excavating at Knossos, he finds the pictographic script, the hieroglyphs. He also finds two types of more linear looking writing written mostly on tablets. And so he calls them the linear script of class A and the linear script of class B. He's not 100% sure what the relationship between the two is, but he can tell that they look a lot like each other, but they're clearly different. So in class B, the tablets are ruled consistently. The numbers are written a bit differently. So there are very clear visual differences. If you look at the two tablets, you can figure out something slightly different is going on in each case. And so we have these two linear scripts, A and B, and because people are lazy and never came up with a better name, we're still stuck calling them Linear A and Linear B, which makes it sound like we're doing algebra or something, which we're not. Well, sometimes we are. When we're dealing with the fractions, people do have to do algebra, but that's not the goal of what we're doing here. I learned enough math to get by, but I'm not a mathematician. So the linear script of class A and the linear script of class B, and he doesn't really know how they relate to each other beyond the fact that they do. And the linear script from class B, it's only really being found at Knossos. The linear A is being found at other sites, especially Iatriada in the Mesra Plain to the southwest. Cretan hieroglyphic is being found at other sites, especially Malia to the northeast. And it does seem like we have something like an east-west differential. Linear A appears pretty much not much later than Cretan hieroglyphic. So we used to think that, you know, hieroglyphic gives way to linear A, it gives way to linear B, sort of like Egyptian hieroglyphs. You have the, you know, the very monumental hieroglyphs, and you get hieratic, which is a more cursive form of this, and then you get demotic, which is the most cursive form, but they are still linked. It's a similar relationship. You can see there are linear A signs that look like more cursive or linear versions of Cretan hieroglyphic signs, and there are linear B signs, which are very clearly linked with. So you can trace the history of some of these signs, though it's very complicated, and I'm trying to do this for a chapter that I'm working on, and the relationship to some of these signs, you have two or three signs sometimes that could all be related, and figuring out how they're related and whether it's only one that's influencing it or that, the whole thing, it's very complicated. And our corpora, the number of inscriptions we have in Cretan hieroglyphic is very small. The number of inscriptions we have in linear A is relatively small. And the number of inscriptions we have in linear B is quite large. And that flows nicely into the next thought, I think, because it's not a coincidence that the only one that we've deciphered is the one with the largest corpus. Basically, unless you are lucky enough to have a bilingual text, so like the Rosetta Stone in Egypt, the Abyssitun inscription in Persia, and I think even Cretan, even Cypriot syllabary was deciphered using a... So most cases of script decipherment, what's happened is we have a bilingual and we're able to especially find names, because names, you know, other words, you know, what names for things like water in different languages, there's no reason that they're going to be similar. You're just going to say however you water, however you say it. Aqua, hudor in Latin and Greek, O in French, water in English. Like knowing these things, you can, like, there's no relationship between these, even when there is an ancestral one, it's normally hard to see. Names, no matter what language you speak, your name is going to be more or less expressed in using the same sounds, even if you don't really understand the sounds, right? Like, so Theodore is a Greek name. And like that doesn't matter. I grew up speaking English, and most people don't think about the fact my name is Greek until I go to Greece, and then it's very easy. People are like, ah, Theodore, like, you know. But like, so the fact that names are the same across languages is very useful for reading scripts, because if you can see the name in one spot, if you know the inscription starts with someone's name, or you can see where that name is, and then in the new script that you don't know, even if you don't know that script, you know that that name is going to have to, the signs in that script are going to have to give you the sounds, something like, that will come out to be something like the name that you find in the first script. More often than not, sometimes people have names in different languages and things like this, but this is how it worked for Egyptian hieroglyphs. Finding like the name Cleopatra was incredibly important. And for old Persian cuneiform, finding the name of King Darius. This is how, and formally, you know, King of Kings, Darius. Once you find those, and then you can figure that out. And that's really that's what you need to do if you have a small corpus, or even if you have a large corpus that you don't understand all that well. And so, you know, when old Persian cuneiform was deciphered, there wasn't really a huge corpus of it because they hadn't, nobody had discovered, when cuneiform was being deciphered, they were doing it on the basis of these large monumental rock inscriptions, which you find across Iran and the Middle East. They weren't doing it on the basis of the massive, massive quantities of tablets, though, you know, with things like Akkadian. So it was easy to decipher, relatively easy. It was not super easy to decipher old Persian cuneiform. The people involved had to like climb the sides of mountains and then get inscriptions, and then they had to be very competent linguists. But it was relatively easy because it was an Indo-European language, right? Old Persian, in fact, modern Persian, is still an Indo-European language. It's closely related to Sanskrit, which people had known for about a century at this point. And so the field of Indo-European linguistics was still young and not what it is today, but you could still see the similarities. And so when you start to find names that look very similar, it's easy to work through these things in a language where you have some understanding of how words and syntax are going to work. In a language where you don't have that, so they had, you know, the Abyssitun inscription is trilingual, Akkadian and Elamite, but because they didn't have a huge amount of the Akkadian, it took a much, much longer time to decipher it, because, you know, knowing the language family is like a cheat code. Because you can see, you can find cognates, and you can see how case endings are, all of these things that, you know, the ancient languages are, tend to be more complex than English in terms of how words are, how words change in order to fit their role within the syntax. And so, and the more you know about this from the language family, and the more you can see how that's working in the new language you're working on, it's much, much easier. And if you have a word whose meaning you don't know, but if you know, if you figured out how things relate to each other within this language family, then you can actually figure out what the word means, even without having any context for it. And so that made deciphering, it's made the decipherment of many languages a lot easier. Similarly with Hittite, which was discovered first at Amarna, but then significantly in at Hattusa in Turkey, just about 100 kilometers east of Istanbul. And when they, so they found these tablets written in cuneiform, and at this point in the early 20th century, they could read Akkadian cuneiform, and they were reading this, and all of a sudden they found the word watar. And then, well, I mean, this looks a lot, and they found a few other words that looked a lot like this, and it's like, this is an Indo-European language. And the fact that, you know, Hittite has this word watar, which for sort of accidental reasons looks exactly like water, but, you know, when you find things like that, you can actually just understand the language so much quicker and so much easier. And so with Linear B, getting back to this idea of the pre-Greek population, so it was always thought from the discovery until the decipherment that Linear B, well, not entirely always, there was, but there was a large current of thought that it was not going to be Greek, that it was going to be this pre-Greek language. A lot of people wanted it to be Etruscan, including the person who actually did decipher it when he was, I think, 18. He published an article that was very, very bad, saying it's Etruscan. And it's not. But this is what people wanted it to be. And it was only later as he... So the decipherment was a long process. It starts with the discovery of the tablets, the categorization of the separate scripts. So if you're trying to decipher Linear B, you can't have Linear A tablets in there. So you have to split these all off. So you have to look closely at the tablets and figure out what goes with what. You have to look closely at the signs and figure out what goes with what, right? Like in English, there's like two different kinds of lowercase g, right? You have the type that everybody writes, and then there's that type that you find in books that nobody ever writes, but everybody still knows is a g with like the two little circles. But if you don't know the English, you know, how the Latin alphabet is used today, figuring out that those two are the same sign is an important part of decipherment, because if you treat them as separate signs, then you're not going to know that they're, say, so, you know, you're going to completely end up down false trails. And so you can use context clues, right? If you find the word George a lot, you're going to see that it's probably starting with a capital G, and then it's going through and you've got that second G, and maybe if sometimes it's spelled with one and sometimes spelled with the other, you're going to guess that because these two alternate freely in the same spot, and if you find other words with the word G in it, you're going to, you can, based on these frequent alternations, you can figure out, okay, these are probably variants of the same sign, and you can figure out how much variation is allowed and how scripts differentiate between signs, right? So our alphabet, we write from left to right, which means that things like B and D, which are mirror images of each other flipped on that vertical axis, can always be in that direction. If our writing system could go right to left or left to right, it would be much tougher to have these signs where that vertical flipping is meaningful, because if you're not sure which way you're reading, you're going to read them as one or the other. So you can figure out a lot about a writing system just by looking at it. And in fact, we knew a lot about Linear B before it was deciphered. A lot of the categorizations of tablets were done by Emmett Bennett, who was a graduate student of Carl Blagan when he was excavating at Pylos. Because so we found a bunch of Linear B tablets at Knossos, but they were very slow to be published. Evans, in a system which still basically works today, if you are the director of an excavation, you get to publish your stuff. And if you don't want to publish it, you're the one who gets to decide who will publish it. And so Evans basically published everything himself. It was a little bit different. He also never really published a lot of things properly. He wrote this massive series of books, I guess you could call it, 7 volumes, The Palace of Minos. And it's not really a scientific excavation report like we would expect to find today. It's part that, it's part synthesis, it's part wild speculation. It's strange to read it because you'll go from, we were excavating here and we found these things and there was this pottery on the floor and then it seems to date from this period, very sort of sober stuff. And then all of a sudden he'll be like connecting it to something that he thinks he knows about Egypt or something like this. And it goes from fact to fancy quicker than any publication any other publication. It's really strange book. A lot of developing anthropological theory. Like, he definitely read Sir James Frazer, The Golden Bough. Like, he's pulling in all kinds of stuff on top of it. It's a monumental work, right? This is what people still think of when we think of the Minoans, was this massive synthetic work that Evans produced after excavating Knossos. And for better or for worse, you know, he's right about a lot of things and has good reasons to think many of the things that he does, but he's way off base with so many others. And so he was working on this. This is what he prioritized after he finished excavating Knossos. And in fact, he only got to excavation relatively late in life. And so he dies, I think, in the 1930s. So within 30 years, he excavates this entire palace, publishes everything himself. It's a lot. And it's only really after he dies, he leaves the publication of the tablets to an Oxford friend. And this is when things start to, between that and between the discoveries at Pylos, would start to take off. Carl Blagan, the American archaeologist, discovers quite a few linear B tablets at Pylos in 1939. They're digging in like the summer of 1939, right before war breaks out. And in fact, it's a trial excavation at this point. So they go to the local farmer and they say, hey, can we like dig here? And he's like, yeah, cool. But, you know, like, leave it how you found it. So they start digging, they dig down. The first room they find is the archive complex. They're finding all these tablets. End of the season comes, they fill it back in, they plant new olive trees for them and go home. And then World War II happens and they don't get to go back for like 15 years, or they go back in the early 1950s. But the advantage of this is that all of a sudden, both because the tablets, there's more movement on the tablets from Knossos, and there's new tablets from Pylos, which are being published much quicker, there's more stuff for people to look at. And so various people who have access to the Knossos tablets and the Pylos tablets start to work on them and start to find patterns within them. So the thing about Linear B is that, unlike other scripts, which are deciphered using a bilingual, it was deciphered entirely from internal evidence. And there was no key. They had no Rosetta Stone. They had no bilingual inscription. They only had the texts themselves. We did have the related Cypriot syllabary, which ended up being very important. So we had new, there were a few signs that overlap between, so the Cypriot syllabary, so writing on Crete happens, and we have Cretan hieroglyphic and Linear. Linear A seems to be one of the models for a writing system which we find on Cyprus, also in the Bronze Age, starting around 1600 BC. A writing system that we still can't read and don't entirely understand. These things like, is this a same sign or a different sign? These questions are still very live, because, you know, you can change the value of a sign by adding a little dash to it in some writing systems. But in other writing systems, if you add a dash to something, it's, you know, it's like a serif. It's just decorative, right? You can write a 1 with a line, or you can write a 1 with a dash and a base. But in some writing systems, doing those things would change the meaning. And without knowing the language underlying it, it's very difficult to figure these things out. So we call it Cypro-Minoan because of this Linear A influence, though it's very much its own thing. It's very much not just Linear A copied over to Cyprus. There's definitely influence from, you know, Cyprus is a place where they're writing in cuneiform. And so they're very much entangled in this other culture of writing coming from the East. But it appears that this system survives down into the historical period. And while Greeks elsewhere are using their own, the Greek alphabet, which still basically the alphabet that they use to write Greek today, the Cypriots are still using this syllabary. And so we, in some of these signs, because it goes back to linear A and because linear B goes back to linear A, some of the signs actually are shared and they actually have the same value, which is sort of how we know that if it's in the separate syllabary with this value, and if it's in linear B with this value, that must go back to the linear A value. So a note on syllabaries. So our alphabet is an alphabet, and that's both a name and a technical term. We mark consonants and vowels separately. Every letter is a single sound, right? T is T, A is aw, all of these things. If you want to spell the word cat, you put together C-A-T, cat. That's not the only way of writing, and it's not actually the most efficient way of writing always. So depending on how your language is structured, but a lot of ancient writing systems, really all ancient writing down to the invention of the Greek alphabet somewhere around 850 BC, maybe, big question. Not written using alphabets, written using syllabaries. And so a syllable is like the smallest pronounceable element of a name, right? Like Theodore. So you're going to have consonants and vowels going together. Because this is, you know, consonant actually means it sounds with. You can only really say a consonant if you're adding a vowel to it. Otherwise, you're just making a bare noise. And the idea that you can just denote the basic noise, like duh, is not, that's not a necessarily a clear thing when you're thinking about how to turn speech into writing. It's much easier to take, it's easy to split up a word into syllables. It's what you do to write poetry and something which is familiar. And so just writing those syllables makes perfect sense. So a syllabary, if you think of my name, Theodore, if you think of it in Greek, it's Theodoros. So it's got that Greek ending. So instead of using eight letters to write it in English, using a syllabary where you just break it down to syllables, it has four syllables, you can use four signs. All right? Theodoro. Four signs, quicker, easier. And that works well because each syllabaries get tough if you end up having a lot of consonants in a row. So if you think about, so the linear B syllabary, the Cypriot syllabary, and it seems like linear A before them and probably Cretan hieroglyphic too, it's always a consonant and then a vowel. Now, that works well for a name, Nicholas, Nico, but then even then that final S is tough, right? But if you think of a word like strength, where you have an eight-letter word with one vowel, if you have to spell that out using only signs that are consonant plus vowel, you're going to have a lot of dead space. And it's going to be very hard to figure out what, in fact, you're trying to spell. So these things work better for some languages than for others. And it seems like this basic model of consonant vowel worked really well for the Minoan language because that's what they used. And there are many languages today that always end in an open syllable like that. And it's, you don't have these complex consonant clusters that make it tough. Greek does have them, so the use of this writing system, this syllabary, to write the Greek language is complicated, and it's how we sort of know that linear B wasn't. It's not how you would develop a system to write Greek. If you're going to develop a system to write Greek, you're probably going to develop an alphabet where you can put as many vowels in a row as you want, you put as many consonants in a row as you want, and that just works better for the Greek language. But because they're inheriting this system, or deliberately, you know, taking it over, it looks a little bit different, and they're using this system, which isn't perfect for writing the Greek language, but works well enough, right? People get hung up on this isn't the perfect system, so it must be a bad one. Well, no, it's not the perfect system, but it's very much good enough for what they want to do, which is make administrative records, right? Your language system, your writing system, as long as everybody understands what you're doing, works. Like, English is a mess, right? Like, why is there a K at the beginning of night? Like, why are half the letters in the word night, right? It's not the most efficient writing system. If people took that view to how we write words today, which some people try to, like, English spelling would look completely different. And so writing is not, like, scientific, right? It doesn't have to be efficient and easy all the time. As long as everybody understands what's going on, that's enough.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all so much for joining us on the study of antiquity and the Middle Ages. PhD student Theo Nash did an awesome job of taking us through the complicated and sometimes humorous archaeology of the ancient Aegean, especially involving language and writing systems. But also he pointed out the complexity of learning these systems, how in many cases we're still attempting to unravel them. And honestly, it was a fascinating episode. Theo, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Nick. It was a great chat.